So Thomas gave this beautiful overview, and what I would like to do is to tell you, in fact, it's a nice continuation of almost the last transparencies that Thomas had, namely, what are the lessons we can learn from various models that have been solved exactly. The models I will discuss were developed by a whole bunch of people, and there is a short pedagogical review only for the cosmological model part of it in this in a recent paper. So, introduction. As Thomas explained to us, there really has been a lot of progress on the mathematical front, on conceptual and mathematical fronts of loop quantum gravity. There has been, for example, the master constraint program, and Thomas did not go into it, but there are also very interesting developments on so-called algebraic quantum gravity. And there is excellent control on the kinematics of loop quantum gravity because of the uniqueness theorem that was proved in 2006. And there are these new approaches to dynamics, that is to say, solving the quantum constraints. But I think reliable physical predictions for the full theory are yet to appear. And in particular, there are two central questions that I would like to know answers to. The first is, what does full loop quantum gravity have to say about interesting kind of really conceptual questions which have been with us since the 70s, raised by, you know, Peter Bergman, John Wheeler, Bryce DeWitt, and so on. For example, about the fate of singularities of classical general relativity. What is the quantum nature of the Big Bang itself? And in fact, was there a pre-Big Bang branch, as is often postulated by string-inspired models such as the pre-Big Bang cosmologies or ekpyrotic universes? And finally, another puzzle that has been with us for, again, about 30 years is this puzzle about the information loss in the black hole evaporation process. So what does full loop quantum gravity have to say about these very interesting physical problems? It has answered some physical issues, I mean, like the entropy and the resolution of certain singularities in the mini superspaces. But as far as the full loop quantum gravity is concerned, we really have these issues facing us. And finally, and to me, this is the most kind of frustrating part of the status, current status, is really that, as Thomas pointed out, there are many quantization ambiguities that come up when you go to dynamics. And what we would like to know is really, what is the physical meaning of these ambiguities? That there are ambiguities doesn't bother me that much. But if we could understand physically what it means, what are the implications, if we resolve them in a particular way, as opposed to be resolving them in some other way, then I think we would make really rapid progress. And the interesting thing is that such questions can be answered in the symmetry reduced models, and the complete analysis is available in cosmological models, which is k equal to 1 or k equal to 0, coupled to a massless scalar field. There can be other matter there, but there should be one massless scalar field to simplify the analysis. There may be a cosmological constant, or there may not be. There are also partial results for k equal to minus 1 and Bianchi models. And finally, for certain black holes, which are midi superspaces, which have infinitely many degrees of freedom. I would emphasize that what one has done in these models is really done everything we want to do in full loop quantum gravity. Namely, there is actually the physical sector of the theory. Not only is the Hamiltonian constraint solved, but the physical states are known. There is a physical sector of the theory, and we can extract semi-classical states. We can address the issues that Balakos are talking about, and in fact, we can extract physics from it. And we can see, furthermore, what are the new things that come up, because the theory, as Balak said, is much richer at the Planck scale than, for example, the older Wheeler-DeWitt theory. So the goal of this talk is really twofold. First, I would like to provide a few highlights of the results obtained in these models, and by an essentially complete analysis of these symmetry-reduced models, both in cosmological sector and the black hole sector. And I would like to give some examples of lessons that they have for full loop quantum gravity. Now, the first reaction about these symmetry-reduced models, including mine, was that, well, these are really toy models. I mean, full loop quantum gravity is much, much richer and much more complicated. And therefore, you know, maybe this teaches some lesson, but it's really very limited applicability. But I'd like to point out that the examples can be very powerful. For example, supposing hypothetically, just to make a parallel with quantum gravity, we had somehow the full quantum electrodynamics, but we did not have much experimental data. Somebody came up and developed full quantum electrodynamics and, you know, told you all about the quantum field effects. And then Dirac, supposing, came about and said, well, you know, let us switch off all the electromagnetic degrees of freedom, all the photons. Let us just keep spherically symmetric modes of the electromagnetic field, and let us just solve the Dirac equation in this presence, and therefore we will just get the hydrogen atom, the Dirac's hydrogen atom. I mean, our first reaction would have been, wait a minute. I mean, you threw out so much that you're not going to be really approximating nature very well. And yet we know that this is an excellent approximation to what full quantum electrodynamics might have to tell us. So it could be that, in fact, some of these models may give us actually an excellent approximation to the physics of the, to certain aspects of the physics of the problem that they address. In class, so this was an example from quantum gravity. The two next examples are from classical general relativity. The singularity theorems versus the discovery of singularities in simple models. First, singularities were discovered only in, you know, highly symmetric models. And therefore, it was always thought, in fact, there was a whole Russian school working on this, thinking that, in fact, generically, there will be no singularities. These are just artifacts of certain, you know, symmetry assumptions. And this turned out to be completely incorrect. Similarly, the Bianchi models, which are homogeneous, serve certain behavior of the gravitational field near the singularities, and the Belinsky-Kolapnikov-Lifshitz conjecture was made. And now, again, for 30 years ago, most people didn't believe in it, but there is now more and more support in favor of this conjecture, which came from highly symmetric models. Of course, this does not imply that the behavior found in examples would be generic, but rather this says that, well, one should not just dismiss it a priori, especially if it gives us some results which are kind of, in a broad sense, physically appealing. So the talk is in four parts, introduction, which I just finished, and then cosmological models, black hole models, and then just a very brief summary. So what about cosmological models? Well, in this simplest models, the full loop quantum gravity program can be completed. There's a physical Hilbert space, there are observables, there are semi-classical states, and by combination of analytical and numerical methods, one can extract physics out of these models. Let me take for concreteness and for sort of pedagogical reasons, thing that will enable me to give you the most information, and that would be a K equal to 1 Friedman-Robertson-Walker model with a massless scalar field. As I said, you could have other matter fields as well here, but I'm just concentrating here with a massless scalar field and also without a cosmological constant. Now, this model is instructive because every classical solution in this model is singular. So each solution basically begins with a big bang. The universe expands out to a maximal volume. This is a classical theory. And then it recollapses. This is a classical recollapse. And it recollapses into a big crunch singularity. Now, therefore, if this is the volume of the universe, and this is the scalar field. And so you can see that, in fact, given any value of the volume, there are two points in this classical trajectory with the same volume. And therefore, scale factor, or the volume, is not a good global clock because of the classical recollapse. But the scalar field is clearly a very good clock. Scalar field is monotonic up here. So we could use that as an internal clock and actually complete the program, the quantization program, construct the Hilbert space, physical Hilbert space and everything, and then go on and see what happens. Now, if you use the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which has been known in these models for a very long time, then we can ask the following question. First of all, we can have the physical Hilbert space. So that is to say, we've got the solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with the inner product, with observables, and so on. And one can say, let us be somewhere here where the universe is expanding and is very large. Let us construct a rigorous semi-classical state peaked at such a point, and let us evolve backward in the phi time, or forward in the phi time. using the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Well, what happens is, the good news is that in fact, the Wheeler-DeWitt trajectory follows the classical trajectory very well. These are the spreads or the uncertainties. These are the spread of the wave function. It follows it very well, undergoes a recollapse. That is very nice. But the bad news is that if you go backward in time or in forward in time, then the trajectory goes back into the singularity in both cases. So the singularity is not resolved. What happens in loop quantum cosmology? Again, in loop quantum cosmology, we can start at such a point in the classical trajectory and again construct a semi-classical state which is peaked at this point. This is the volume and this is the scalar field. There's a complete set of Dirac observables in this case. Therefore, one knows what it means to say the semi-classical state is peaked at this point. And then we evolve backward and forward. Well, in the forward evolution, it is similar to the Wheeler-DeWitt case. There is a classical recollapse. That is good. It follows a classical trajectory faithfully. However, just when the density becomes, matter density becomes about 0.8 times the Planck density, there's a huge departure from the classical behavior. In the classical behavior, this trajectory would have gone into the singularity, the Big Bang singularity, and the future evolution into the Big Crunch singularity. But rather, the quantum geometry has a certain repulsive force, and this repulsive force overwhelms the classical attraction when the densities are of the order of about 0.8 times the Planck density, and the universe bounces, undergoes a quantum bounce. And therefore, we have this scenario in which you can start out here, instead of starting with a Big Bang, you start out with a state of very high density, it expands out, undergoes classical recollapse, undergoes a quantum bounce, undergoes a classical recollapse, and so on. So the classical singularities are resolved, and furthermore, not only are these ultra-violet problems resolved, but there is a faithful reproduction, faithful following the classical trajectory at large scales. So in this region, we expect general relativity to be valid to an excellent degree of approximation, and it indeed is. So I told you about k equal to 1. What about the more physically interesting model, k equal to 0? In this case, the classical trajectories are of two types. One of them begins with a Big Bang and expands out forever. The other one starts with an infinite volume, contracts into a Big Crunch singularity. So these trajectories don't talk to these trajectories. They are distinct. But in loop quantum gravity, again, if I take this expanding branch, take a semi-classical state which is peaked at this point, and evolve it forward in time, it follows a classical trajectory. Evolve it backward in time, it follows a classical trajectory until the density becomes, again, 0.8 times the Planck density. And instead of following the classical trajectory into the singularity, there's a bounce, and therefore these two trajectories, the contracting branch and the expanding branch, which in the classical theory were unrelated to each other, are joined by a single quantum solution. Again, the Big Bang singularity is resolved, and there is actually a pre-Big Bang branch. Unlike in the string-inspired scenarios, like ekpyrotic models and the pre-Big Bang model, this evolution is completely deterministic. In these other models, the evolution is not deterministic. They have a pre-Big Bang branch and a post-Big Bang branch. But how they are joined together, one does not know. One just makes appeal to some as yet an unknown or a physics which is not under control, non-perturbity physics, which will join these trajectories. But in loop quantum cosmology, there is a completely quantum mechanically deterministic evolution. Now, you can look at k equal to 0 at lambda bigger than 0 model. And Tomasz Pawlowski will speak on this a little bit in the session this afternoon, I think. In this case, something new happens. What happens in this case is that the classical trajectory starts with Big Bang and expands out, but it reaches infinite volume in the finite internal clock scalar field time. So this is a little mathematically like having a potential in ordinary particle mechanics where the potential is, so to say, negative and is steep and going down, so potential is being plotted like that. And if you put a particle somewhere, the particle rushes out to infinity in a finite amount of time. When this happens classically, quantum mechanically, the Hamiltonian is not essentially self-adjoint. There are many self-adjoint extensions which will tell you, basically, if the particle reached infinity at finite time, then what happens next? And there is ambiguity, and these ambiguities are captured in the self-adjoint extension of the operator. In this case, exactly the same thing is true. In fact, the operator is not self-adjoint, is not essentially self-adjoint. It admits many self-adjoint extensions, and they actually give you very interesting different behaviors for the full quantum theory. However, all of them agree on semi-classical states. So it's a very beautiful mixture of phenomena that is coming up in this particular model. In the negative cosmological constant model is much more tame. Classically, there is a recollapse, which is reproduced by quantum loop quantum gravity. And the Big Bang and the Big Crunch singularities are resolved. Okay. So what are the lessons we can learn from this analytical and numerical analysis that has been performed? Well, one of the questions that came up several times is, does loop quantum gravity have a good semi-classical limit? Now, the point up here is the following. As was discussed at the end of the last talk, sort of the beautiful thing is that there are these very non-trivial things, non-trivial quantum geometry effects at the Planck scale that change the dynamics at the Planck scale in loop quantum gravity. And therefore, that cures ultraviolet problems, as Thomas explained to us. And in particular here, those problems are cured, and therefore the singularity is avoided. But the question is, these small effects, could they accumulate on a long period of time? And we really, the evolution of the universe is really very, very long, and there is a low curvature, long history of the universe. Could it be that these effects accumulate on long period of time, and if they accumulate like that, then it could be that in fact there is a disagreement with classical general relativity in ordinary regimes, like around us today. And that would be experimentally falsified. And this concern was actually expressed by Green and Andrew in the K equal to 1 case. Namely, their analysis was based on an older form of the Hamiltonian constraint, and they thought that in fact loop quantum cosmology would not predict the classical recollapse that the general relativity predicts. But this is actually not the case with the improved loop quantum cosmology dynamics that was discovered last year in the cosmological context. And there's a classical recollapse, there's agreement with general relativity. And to me, it was instructive to find out, and what is the limit? Until when is the classical general relativity valid? So you have got a huge universe like ours, which expands out to a very large volume. You expect classical general relativity to be valid. But suppose I had a universe which, in k equal to 1 case, expanded out only to, say, 100 Planck length and collapsed. Would classical general relativity be valid? What about a million Planck lengths? Where does it stop? And surprisingly, classical recollapse is valid within 2%. You get exactly the same results as classical theory. Even for tiny universes which grow only up to maximum radius about 25 Planck length. And therefore, there is a really important viability test of loop quantum cosmology that has been met. But let us continue about this issue about semi-classical limit. There has been in the literature a certain Hamiltonian constraint, certain way of quantizing the Hamiltonian constraint, which in fact, in the form that I'm referring to, was introduced by Jurek Lewandowski, Martin Boyol, and myself. I was one of the authors. And this was called the mu naught evolution. And the newer evolution is called mu bar. In both cases, the idea is the same. Namely, we have got this field strength operator. And this field strength operator, as Thomas explained, is replaced by holonomy around a loop of minimum area, the area gap, so to say. So this particular procedure, in both these cases, systematizes the quantization procedure. It is sometimes in the literature, one says that, well, I just take some classical expression, and wherever there is a connection C, I just replace it by sine C lambda over lambda. If you do this, there are many, many quantization ambiguities, and it's not controlled. The procedure up here systematically follows what is happening in the full theory until a certain stage, because in models would not have a diffeomorphism invariance as we have in the full theory. But because it is systematic procedure, which sort of makes a physical idea, namely that the holonomies should be describing the field strength. And the physical idea that there is in fact a loop of minimum area. So this is therefore a much more systematic procedure shared by both mu naught and mu bar evolution. The difference is that in the mu naught evolution, the area here is with respect to the fiducial metric that is used in quantization, whereas in mu bar, it is a physical metric. And this is one of the nice things that comes out of this very beautiful confluence of mathematical and physics ideas. Namely, physically you would expect that only the areas of the physical metric should be quantized. And when you put that in fact, the dynamics is changed in a very subtle way, but in a very important way. Namely, in the mu naught evolution, qualitatively everything looked very similar, but these models enabled us to look at it in great detail, and then it was found that in fact, the quantum bounds in this evolution can occur even at low densities, even at density of water. It depends on what state you consider, and more semi-classical the state, worse the problem becomes. And therefore, this is a gross violation of the semi-classical limit. So there really is a quantization ambiguity here, but this quantization ambiguity is giving rise to dramatic effects, physical effects. And these are the kinds of lessons we should take to the full theory. That we should not just say, well, you can do this and you can do that, but in fact, we should follow what the physical implications of various choices are. Now, sometimes it is argued that we could still use mu naught evolution, and the problem with mu naught evolution is an artifact of the homogeneity assumption, and this will just go away if we use inhomogeneous models. But if that is the case, if in fact we don't want to trust the mu naught evolution because of these artificial predictions, then you should not trust the mu naught evolution in these models also for singularity resolution. So the statement is that in fact we can drive ourselves to better and better physical pictures, better and better physical ideas through these models. So the correct semi-classical limit heavily constrains how ambiguities of the quantum Hamiltonian constraints are resolved, and we should perhaps learn this and take this to the full theory. A few other lessons. I mean, initially, in fact, some of the cosmology experts, leading people are still confused about this a little bit. Initially, in the k equal to 1 model, people always thought that, well, the effects, quantum gravity effects should become important only when the size of the universe is about a Planck length size, a 10 Planck length size or something. This is not at all the case. In fact, if you consider a universe which grows to a maximum radius of 1 megaparsec before undergoing a classical recollapse, the quantum bounds occurs at 10 to the 115 Planck volumes. You know, when the universe is, the radius is more than a kilometer. Normally one would say that, well, if the universe is so big, then quantum effects are not important. But for a universe which grows to this size, already at this stage, the curvature becomes Planck size. And therefore quantum effects are of course important. Densities become Planck size. And so it's not the volume that is important, but it's curvature, observable quantities, curvature, density, and so on. The new repulsive force from quantum geometry, which is responsible for singularity resolution in these models, it really comes completely from quantum geometry. The modifications of the matter Hamiltonian, so-called inverse volume effect, in this simple model, the homogeneous models, they do not play a role if the universe grows to macroscopic size. Because the minimum volume of the universe is several kilometers, and therefore inverse effects, which would be really important when the size of the universe is about a Planck length or a few Planck lengths, the semi-classical universe never reaches that era. So the key factor here is really not so much the modifications of the matter Hamiltonian, as far as this simple model is concerned, but rather the fact that the field strength is really replaced by the holonomy, and the holonomy is non-local. And I think there is some deep hint here for the full theory, and it would be good to understand what that hint is. Finally, as in classical general relativity, physical interpretation is difficult. The physical interpretation is difficult if we actually use a manifestly 3D diffeomorphism invariant framework. This is also one of the answers to Bailhache's question. The way loop quantum gravity has been, in the full theory, has been developed is really taking care of the diffeomorphism invariance by keeping everything three-dimensional diffeomorphically invariant, not by gauge fixing. And if you do that, even with classical relativity, it is very difficult to actually do the usual physics, because the usual physics, we have a metric, not a diffeomorphism equivalence class of metrics out of which we are trying to extract physics. And so this suggests that maybe a complementary strategy, of course we should keep doing what we're doing, but perhaps develop a complementary strategy for the full theory, namely focus on some nonlinear neighborhoods of the physically interesting phase-space points, gauge fix the diffeomorphism constraint, and study the physical implications of the Hamiltonian constraint then. There's also some recent work which give rise to k equal to 0, lambda equal to 0 model, which gives us analytical understanding. What I said so far is a mixture of analytical and numerical methods, but there is a simplified model which actually can be solved exactly. So what happens is the following. If I look at loop quantum gravity in this improved mu bar quantization, the Hamiltonian constraint is a difference operator in the volume, and it is difficult to solve analytically. But in the expression, there are two functions called A and B, which appear as coefficients, that are functions of the volume, and A of V is just equal to V when V is bigger than 1 in Planck units, and if V is less than 1, then it's a more complicated form. And B of V is just equal to in volume to the minus 1 if the inverse volume corrections are ignored. So let us set A equal to V and B equal to this, and these are well-motivated approximations because of what I just said, namely that physically realistic universes really do not reach these particular values. So this should be a good physically motivated approximation for the quantum constraint, and now the resulting model can be solved analytically. It's rather close, it's similar to the model that Martin Boyerwald proposed earlier this year, or end of last year, which can also be solved exactly. The difference is that Martin started with a classical constraint and quantized it kind of following the loop quantum cosmology prescriptions, but not in a kind of a systematic way. In other words, it was well motivated by that, but it was not one did not start with the quantum loop quantum cosmology constraint and then simplify it. Here, one starts with the quantum loop quantum cosmology constraint, the quantum constraint, and then simplifies. So this is more clearly related. The relation between the full loop quantum cosmology and this model is more transparent. So in this model then, what we can do is we can use a variable B, which is canonically conjugate to the volume. And if we use a representation in which a wave function depends on this B and phi, then both in the Wheeler-DeWitt theory and the loop quantum cosmology, one just gets the differential equations, and we all know how to solve differential equations, and that is why it is exactly soluble. So we get these simple differential equations. The difference is that instead of B up here in the differential operator, we get here sine lambda B by lambda, but this is not just postulated, it came from this systematic procedure of replacing the field strength by a holonomy operator. In fact, the physical Hilbert spaces of the two theories are naturally isomorphic in this case. So it's really very exciting. Here is loop quantum cosmology, here is Wheeler-DeWitt theory. And you can identify the states in a very natural way in both the theories. It's the same Hilbert space. So one would say, well, but how can the predictions be different? Well, they're different because the Dirac observables are expressed differently in the two cases. In particular, the volume at a given instant of time, this Dirac observable, its expression is very different in the two Hilbert spaces. So what happens is the following, that if you look at loop quantum cosmology, then on a dense subspace of the physical Hilbert space, the simplified loop quantum cosmology exhibits a quantum bounce, in the following sense. See, if you give me completely random physical state, not semi-classical, spread out everywhere, etc., it's not even clear what you mean by bounce. The only meaning I could give in such generality is you look at the expectation value of the volume, and is it the case that as time goes to plus infinity and minus infinity, the volume is actually becoming infinite? If the volume is becoming infinite both at plus infinity and minus infinity, and it is finite in between, then there is a quantum bounce. And the statement here is that in this precise sense, the quantum bounce is actually generic. Now, also the same dense subspace of the physical Hilbert space, the Wheeler-DeWitt theory mimics classical general relativity in the sense that, So it does not give us bounds, but it mimics classical general relativity in the sense that as phi goes to minus infinity in the distant past, the volume of the universe goes to zero, goes to the Big Bang singularity, and as phi goes to plus infinity, the universe expands out, and the volume becomes infinity. Or you can have the other possibility, in which case the universe starts out of the infinite and then undergoes a collapse to a Big Crunch singularity. So on a dense subspace, the physical Hilbert space, Wheeler-DeWitt theory has singularities, and on this dense subspace, not only there are no singularities, but the quantum bounds is generic in this sense. It also makes us the relation between the loop quantum cosmology and Wheeler-DeWitt theory more precise. It says the following. Supposing we start the same physical state at a given instant of time, because the Hilbert spaces are the same, and we evolve it using simplified loop quantum cosmology or Wheeler-DeWitt theory. Then two things happen. First of all, certain predictions of simplified loop quantum cosmology approach to those of Wheeler-DeWitt theory as the area gap goes to zero. See, area gap is what distinguishes quantum geometry from no quantum geometry of Wheeler-DeWitt theory. So some predictions of the loop quantum cosmology go to the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. And basically what the prediction is the following, that if you give me a finite amount of time, if you give me any, so let's look at this branch up here. Let us look at this loop quantum cosmology branch up here. And you give me a finite period of time, these two anywhere up here, because this goes to infinity. Then on that finite period of time, you can approximate the Wheeler-DeWitt theory with loop quantum gravity to an arbitrary accuracy by taking the area gap as small as you want. However, if you want to understand the relation between the two theories for all times, then Wheeler-DeWitt theory could never approximate loop quantum gravity. So basically, certain predictions go through. Given a finite interval of time and epsilon greater than zero, then there exists a delta such that if you choose the area gap to be less than delta, just by hand, physically area gap has some value, just by hand you take this limit, then the physical predictions of the two theories approach are within epsilon of each other. However, the approximation is not uniform. The Wheeler-DeWitt theory is not the limit of loop quantum cosmology. Namely, given n greater than zero, however large, there exists a time such that the difference between the predictions of the two theories is bigger than n. And there is also a precise sense in which, if I just forget about Wheeler-DeWitt theory and just look at loop quantum cosmology by itself, then loop quantum cosmology does not have a limit as the area gap goes to zero. So the discreteness is fundamental and is very important. So this is the larger part of the examples. Now let me come to black holes and the issue of information loss. So we're changing gears now. And already Thomas explained to us the issues in black hole physics. I would like to talk about a so-called CGHS black holes, Callan, Giddings, Harvey, and Strominger black holes. These really are four-dimensional black holes, which are spherically symmetric, and therefore we can do a dimensional reduction and get a 1+1-dimensional model. But in this model, there is also a dilaton field. They came from some string theory model, therefore there is also a dilaton field. It's not just Einstein gravity. But it is very closely related to the spherically symmetric reduction of general relativity with a massless scalar field. So here we're talking about mini-superspaces where I got infinitely many degrees of freedom. Now, the true degree of freedom can be put just in the massless scalar field, because in spherical symmetric case, gravitational field does not have true degrees of freedom in its own right. So you can build a fiducial Minkowski space, M0 and eta, and on that, we got the scalar field F. Now, it says we are in two dimensions, and the scalar field just satisfies the wave equation. You have got the left-going modes and the right-going modes. Let me just concentrate on the left-going modes up here, F+. Now, the point is that all we have is this boring field F, which is just going from scry minus to scry plus. That's all, F plus. But out of this, a black hole emerges in classical relativity. How is that possible? Well, the physical metric is not eta, is not Minkowski metric, but is conformally related to it. And the conformal factor is completely determined by this F. And you can show that in fact there is a space-like line with respect to the Minkowski metric such that omega vanishes on this line. On this line where omega vanishes, the curvature of the physical metric blows up, and this is a singularity. So we can have a black hole formation due to gravitational collapse. In this picture, nothing is happening, but the physical metric is omega times eta, and this metric is only well-defined in this region, and this is the gravitational collapse with a singularity. This part is missing from classical general relativity. Now, given this black hole metric, you can do quantum field theory on this black hole space-time. And what you can do is you can give ourselves a vacuum state for the right-moving mode, F minus, and see that if I give myself a vacuum state up here, what happens on sky plus up here. Well, there are several ways to do it, but a neat way is to just use the trace anomaly. Namely, this is zero rest mass field, so classically, the trace of the stress energy tensor for F minus is just zero. But quantum mechanically, because I got curved region up here, it's a black hole metric, the trace of the quantum stress energy tensor is not zero. There's an anomaly. So we, from this anomaly, the geometry determines T, the trace, and then conservation equations and the boundary condition determine T hat AB completely. And therefore, we can look at what is the flux of the F minus field up here, and you find that it is precisely Hawking radiation. And now the question is, can we take into account back reaction? And this would be semi-classical gravity, and there was a great deal of work on this in the 90s, but it was inconclusive. The picture that people came up with this based on numerical simulations was the following. We got sky plus, sky minus, we got F minus up here. The black hole actually evaporates by radiating Hawking quanta of the F minus field up here. And therefore the singularity, instead of going all the way up here, shrinks. And we got a marginally trapped tube. So it's like a dynamical horizon, which shrinks to a single point up here. And people could calculate what the metric was in this region. And then they just extrapolated and said, well, we just extrapolate this metric, and therefore this Penrose diagram would be like this. And since this Penrose diagram still has, kind of is incomplete here, there's some region missing up here, therefore if I give myself a vacuum state up here and evolve it forward, part of the information goes into this, what was a singularity, and part of the information goes to sky, and therefore it looks like the information is not resolved. But now we can do canonical quantization, we can do full quantum gravity and try to see what happens. This is a joint work with Madhavan Varadarajan and Victor Tavares, and Victor is going to speak about this a little bit. There's a consistent framework which exists, but a complete quantum solution is not yet available. But what we can do is make some successive approximation, and let me not go into the details of this approximation, but basically there is a bootstrapping and then taking expectation values. And when you do that, you recover the classical black hole metric from the quantum fundamental equations, which came from canonical quantization. But then there is a more systematic mean field approximation. So in this case, we basically ignore the quantum fluctuations of geometry in the Dilaudan field, but not of the matter field F hat. And therefore, in the fundamental equations, we can just replace the geometric fields by their expectation value, but not by the matter fields. And when you do that, then in fact you get a closed system, there is no bootstrapping, and you get a semi-classical gravity as a systematic approximation from the full theory. So up to now, we have systematically obtained what people were doing, but from top down, from quantum gravity to semi-classical gravity. But there's also a new element. We can solve the semi-classical equations analytically near sky plus. So this is what was missing. Previously, people had this picture, but we can actually solve the semi-classical equation along sky plus up here. And therefore, the total picture looks like this. That in fact, this bit is also part of the quantum space-time. And now, the sky plus of the semi-classical metric, which is the correct semi-classical metric, is really as large as the sky plus of the Minkowski metric that we started out with. Therefore, if you give me a pure state here, that pure state doesn't get lost. This is all quantum geometry, is well-defined, and the information is just reproduced on this sky plus. So the vacuum state up here with respect to eta is just the vacuum state with respect to eta up here. However, with respect to the physical metric up here, it does not appear like a vacuum state. But in fact, you actually get a pure state which approximates the thermal radiation up here. There is no information loss, but the pure state resembles the thermal state in the past. Now, the important thing is that in contrast to the cosmological models, there is now a region in which there is no smooth semi-classical metric that can approximate quantum geometry. Here, the fluctuations of the metric are really truly large, and therefore, it literally is true that quantum geometry up here is really regularizing the singularity, but quantum geometry is genuinely quantum mechanical. It is not semi-classical in this particular region up here. So, in this case, the evolution actually goes through a genuinely quantum region, but there are semi-classical regions in the past, and there are semi-classical regions in the future. And this is therefore a genuine quantum bounce, as opposed to kind of a semi-classical bounce in the cosmological models. So let me quickly tell you a couple of lessons we learn from this model. First of all, in non-perturbative canonical quantization, there were some ambiguities in the equation which determine the conformal factor, and therefore the quantum geometry from the classical metric. And we first made simple-minded choices in this canonical quantization. And if you did that, then they lead to local Lorentz invariance, or Lorentz violation in the semi-classical equations. However, if you think more about it and realize how this ambiguity should be resolved, then there is a solution such that in the semi-classical level, the local Lorentz invariance is manifest. So, keeping the local Lorentz invariance as much as possible in the semi-classical regime can be a powerful tool in resolving ambiguities also in full loop quantum gravity. Now, to complete the theory, I told you that we do not have a complete theory. We can do some truncations and get physical information out of it. But what we need is something very interesting, and that people like Klaus can perhaps help us about quantum field theory. Namely, what we need to do is, we know how to do quantum field theory in two-dimensional curved spacetimes to get trace anomaly. What we need is a satisfactory extension of the trace anomaly calculations for quantum field theory in curved spacetime to quantum field theory on quantum geometry. Okay. Not the background spacetime is really quantum mechanical by itself. And this is a concrete challenge that we get for quantum gravity. Okay, let me summarize the whole thing now. Basically, in mini-superspaces, cosmology, there's a complete control on the physical sector of the theory. In mini-superspaces, black holes, there is reasonably good control. There are many other models which I've been looked at in great detail, but I had to organize this talk to finish in time, so I just chosen two examples up here. In both cases, the physically interesting classical singularities are resolved, and quantum evolution is deterministic. Quantum space-time in both cases is much larger than the space-time of general relativity. In the cosmological model, the extended space-time has a good description in terms of a smooth metric. This smooth metric has H-bar corrections to it, but it is a smooth metric. In the black hole space-time, the metric fluctuates so dramatically in some small region that there is no smooth metric everywhere. So, in this sense, in cosmology, there is semi-classical bounds, but in black hole, there is genuinely quantum bounds. And this analysis suggests several interesting directions for full loop quantum gravity. The big question is really, what happens generically? Is the singularity resolution an artifact of these models, or is it a generic phenomena which we could understand very simply in the models? So this is an interesting contrast. In classical general relativity, we had singularity existence in symmetric models, and then there are theorems which showed that in fact the existence of singularities is much more generic. Can the converse happen here? Can the reverse happen here? Is there a general singularity resolution theorem for all classical space-time singularities? So here is kind of a nice paradigm. In loop quantum gravity, full theory, one could start out with some state which is peaked at some classical initial data. Classical initial data which, when evolved using classical Einstein's equations, gives rise to a space-like singularity. Now we use loop quantum gravity to evolve this state. The question is, what happens? Are the space-like singularities all resolved? What is the nature of the resolution? Is there a semi-classical bounce generically, or is there a quantum bounce generically, or is it the case that it is neither? Somehow you start with semi-classical thing, you go in the future, and then it could be that there is just a wild fluctuations of the quantum geometry, unlike in the cosmological and black hole models that we've looked at so far. Now, these are key questions for the full theory, and of course people are thinking about these questions very, very carefully through more and more sophisticated models, but I think this is a concrete challenge to various quantization proposals for in full loop quantum gravity. I just want to sort of clarify one confusion in the literature, and the only reason I mention it is because it seems to be growing. It's certainly true that the singularity resolution is in simple models with high degrees of symmetry, and it may be that at the end we may just have quantum foam, maybe a quantum bounce. We don't know what exactly is happening. However, sometimes in the literature, a logic is used which is faulty. Namely, logic is like this. We know that certain assumptions, for example, homogeneity, gives rise to either semi-classical or quantum bounds. And now we also know that if you did perturbations on this homogeneity, and these perturbations remain small, even as we approach the singularity, then one would expect that the bounds will prevail. And both these are kind of, this is a statement which we know, this is a statement which we expect, and I believe this is a correct statement. But then, the reverse conclusion is drawn, namely, if the perturbations grow near the singularity, then that implies bounds will disappear. This just doesn't follow, you know. If A is true, then B is true, does not mean that if A is not true, then B is not true. It's a very elementary logic thing, but there have been arguments along these lines in the literature. And furthermore, one might suspect that, well, maybe this is not a strict logical implication, but there is certainly an indication like that. But recall the singularity theorems and BKL behavior. You know, again, homogeneity implied singularities, but not homogeneity doesn't imply there's no singularities. Similarly with the BKL behavior. And more recently, one of the things that has fascinated me greatly is happening just in classical relativity, has nothing to do with quantum gravity. And that is just the recent numerical evolutions of black hole collisions. People have done post-Newtonian calculations for a long time, and nobody, including me, believed that the post-Newtonian calculations would have validity anywhere near the plunge of the black hole. But these calculations are now showing that numerical calculation, that in fact the post-Newtonian regime is accurate way beyond where we thought it had to be accurate. So again, it's the same thing, you know, A implies B does not mean that not A implies not B. So we should just keep this in mind. Thank you very much.
Wonderful demonstration of the quantum models with the electronic machine logic. Yes.
It's just something I think in the South, meaning that we have to keep all the movement, which I think is so likely. I think this is then the next question that comes to mind is really interesting idea of what you suggested before about the following problem. Let me talk in terms of the big crunch, which is what you have to say about the leadership thing from my head. So suppose I have a influx of universe going to the crunch. Now, the new universe is a high energy that has significant difference. Do you expect to go through, and so in some sense, the time evolution going to be zero or not more, or do you think it's
okay. At the zeroth order, I cannot say anything, because these are just homogeneous models, and the entropy considerations would be useful or would be meaningful and rigorous only, or even believable, only ones who have some non-trivial perturbations and non-trivial inhomogeneities and so on and so forth. So by itself, one cannot say. However, there is something which I just want to sort of just mention a couple of things here about entropy thing. Namely, this is the k equal to 0 case. And the statement up here is the following, that normally we begin with the Big Bang and we expand out. And we say entropy is increasing, and one argues that in fact this singularity is very, very special, and that's why trajectory start out here and they can sort of widely separate out. So there's a large space in place, in phase space, which all originates here, or in terms of Big Crunch, there are a large number of trajectories which all go into this one point in the phase space. So in this case, this point is very, very special. Okay. So I think there is something special about the bounce point. Namely, large number of trajectories, instead of going to the Big Crunch now, as you, in your example, but they're really approaching this bounce point. So there is something to be understood about this bounce point in terms of entropy. But I think this is something that, we'll be able to have a much better grasp only after we look at inhomogeneous situations. But the special role of the singularity is really replaced by the special role of these bounce points, or the bounce, lower dimensional bounce subspace, much, much lower dimensional bounce subspace that you may have.
Hello? And also,
shall I answer this first, or do you want to ask both questions?
And then let me ask the second part, because they are interrelated. It's nice to see the comparison with the old quantization of gravity. And you attribute it to that to the difference, presumably, due to the extremeness of the quantum gravity program. One incidental thing is that there's a group that reported that even in the old periodic equation, if you are clever enough to find the right way to solve it, you can actually get sort of the same result as the quantum gravity. Now, this second part is just ignoring that that cannot be established. So, coming back to this question about where is the discreteness?
Yeah. So, good. Good. So this is, as you say, is a very basic and fundamental question. So the discreteness is really forced upon us by what Thomas explained to us, the uniqueness theorem. It's a kinematical theorem. Namely, if you want to preserve background independence, I want to tell you in sort of stages, right? So roughly, if you want to have background independence and also do mathematics complete, then we are led to a certain representation of this algebra, which has this discreteness. And it's surprising that there is a unique representation, but it has this discreteness. However, one can now step back, as good mathematical physicists would do, and would say, well, every theorem has assumptions. And can we get rid of some of these assumptions and then not have this discreteness? The assumptions here are, again, I'm not giving you complete technicality, but the key assumptions, that there is a certain algebra of quantum kinematical observables that we're looking at. And here, the algebra is made out of holonomies made out of connection, which is very natural. Given a connection, the natural thing is to consider the holonomies or the Wilson loops, Wilson lines, and the conjugate electric fields. So that is the algebra that we're considering. Then we're asking that this algebra should have a representation of a certain kind, so-called cyclic representation, like what happens in quantum field theory in the Minkowski space, which are Poincaré invariant, that there is a state which is actually invariant under the three-dimensional diffeomorphism group. That's what one is asking. It is like asking that there be states which are Poincaré invariant. So three-dimensional diffeomorphism act on this algebra, and we want a state which is invariant. These assumptions give you a unique representation. In that representation, there is an area gap, there is all those things. We're just forced upon this. Of course, you could change something at the very beginning. But if you base the theory on these connections, then we have this fundamental discreteness. Part of the second question. Can I finish the answer? Can I finish the answer?
I'm not. To follow up with this part, what you really get is discreteness in spatial elements, not spatial temporal elements, or temporal elements. When is the hope to realize that?
Okay. So this is a canonical. I think I have to answer this question first and then come back to that, because otherwise everybody will forget what I was saying. So now when you go from loop quantum gravity to loop quantum cosmology, we follow the same procedure as we follow in the loop quantum gravity. Then, even though the system has only finite number of degrees of freedom, we are led to a representation of the basic algebra, which is inequivalent to the Schrodinger representation that was used in Wiener-DeWitt theory. And therefore, the two theories are even kinematically inequivalent. They're different. Even kinematically, they are not the same. So in a way, it is pleasant surprise that in many domains, like when the universe is large and so on, there is agreement between the two things. Okay? But fundamentally, at the mathematical level, even at the kinematical level, the Wiener-DeWitt theory and this loop quantum cosmology theory are really quite different theories. I think this is something that is, of course, finally experimentally determined. But, for example, if you believe in black hole, that there are only finite number of states for a black hole, I mean, it's very difficult to get it in the Wiener-DeWitt quantization. I don't want to say it's impossible because some clever person would do something very, very complicated. So I think it is true that, the standard way or rough way that one people do the Wiener-DeWitt quantization, one could write a paper in precise sense in which it's ruled out, but I think it is ruled out. Now your questions, right? So this is a question that John asked me every conference, because this is his basic thing. And the answer is long, and that's why I did not want to. It's really we're doing canonical program. Now, if you're doing something like spin forms, things will become much more transparent. But in the canonical program, it is necessarily the case that we express full space-time geometry in terms of initial data. Okay? Therefore, if you want to ask a question about the four geometry, that has to be formulated in terms of the initial data. And you can ask this question about, for example, what about the some major quantity, as you were asking. You could give me a physical clock, I could put it, and as you were asking Thomas, construct this major quantity. I have to write down this major quantity in the language of the initial data that we have. And this is not at all something has to do with quantum theory. Quantum theory adds its own wrinkles to it, but conceptually exactly the same thing is true in classical theory. You ask in classical theory some question about proper time separations or something like that. I have to translate it in the canonical program in terms of this initial data. In quantum mechanics, I will have to construct an operator corresponding to your question that you asked. And then I will ask, is it the case that this operator has discrete spectrum or it does not have a discrete spectrum? So this has to be done case by case. And this is the basic issue. And again, many times I answer this by saying that, well, it might seem funny, but it's exactly the same thing is true at a parallel level in ordinary quantum mechanics. Classical mechanics, we've got phase space. We've got arbitrary canonical transformations of the phase space. The group of arbitrary canonical transformations is not promoted to quantum theory. Okay? Something happens. It's not promoted to quantum theory there. So it's very similar to that. That is what is happening here.
You mentioned simplified cosmology. So this is very coincidence, but
A student of mine is working on, he proves certain darkness and finds spectra analytically of the quantum postal generators, and he uses exactly what you call the simplified quantum postal as a kind of device to derive those X-ray results. So maybe the simplification also needs to.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this simplification is both physically motivated and is also mathematically very natural, right? Because there are two functions which are appearing, and we're just slightly changing the form of one function, both of them, in an approximation which is valid away from the singularity. Now, one might say that if I really have universes which grow to less than 25 Planck length, then whose maximum radius is less than 25 Planck length, then the predictions of the simplified model and of loop quantum cosmology will be different from each other. But for anything else, the two are very closely, you know, they're pretty indistinguishable, and I'm agreeing with you completely that this is kind of a natural simplification of the improved dynamics Hamiltonian constraint of loop quantum cosmology. And thank you for telling us about the self-adjoint extensions. I mean, at the broad level, I agree, but I think we had a discussion, and it doesn't seem to me that this is just a manifestation of something like Fell's theorem or something like that. I mean, I don't. So, in a broad context, I agree that this non-uniform approximation is capturing the inequivalence of the two representations. Your question is, much more generally, would it be the case that Fock representation and the polymer representation of loop quantum gravity,
no.
In this case. So in loop quantum cosmology, so it is certainly true that the inequivalence is reflected in the non-uniform approximation. But I don't know what the next question is. I mean, it's certainly true. There's a theorem. Approximation is not uniform, and the two theories are inequivalent in that sense.